Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Marianne Wu joins us today from Palo Alto. Marianne is an investor, board member, and advisor focused on scaling solutions to address climate change. With her current role as a venture partner at both early stage climate tech firm Congruent Ventures and scaling stage firm Standard Investments, she was previously president of GE Ventures and actually started her career in engineering. Some notable investments she's been able to work with include Stem, Enlight, and Desktop Metal, amongst others. Marianne, it's always great to have another of the GE Ventures Mafia join the show. So welcome to the Heavy Hitter. Those were fun days.
Oh, they were definitely fun days. Hey, Ty, great to reconnect with you here and really excited to be on the show.
Awesome. Well, we always kick off with backgrounds and I give my short snippet, but definitely give us more of that color commentary on your journey and the various roles you've held in industry and venture and what you led to what you're doing today at Congruent Ventures.
Yeah, happy to share it. As you said in your intro, the intro for me is, you know, I started my career in engineering. I always loved technology, and I was fortunate that my early roles really kind of exposed me to super dynamic markets where an individual person can make a difference. So my first gig out of engineering school, undergrad engineering, was I worked for a company that's now defunct, but I hope many of your listeners might still remember B&R Nortel, which was a leading telecom giant. And I worked there and ended up introducing the very first generation of sort of broadband optical networks, these WDM products. So I was just one little person, new university graduate, but ended up working and being really impactful against kind of what were world-changing products. And so that was really addictive, this idea that a single individual working in a massive market landscape on a global scale can make a big difference. And so I ended up really kind of focusing my career on opportunities where you could do that. As an individual, you could take advantage of technology and it combined with market trends that a single person could make a big difference. So I later went into startups, which is an obviously concentrated path where you can do that, and worked in operating roles in startups that could, you know, again, scale that level of impact. And then, of course, venture is a natural way to do that as well, that you can work with more companies and with great founders and across more industries to scale that. So that was, you know, that was the path, was that original sort of addiction to developing a product that was world-changing and then wanting to sort of stay in that kind of lane for the rest of my career. I start with saying I always love technology, still do, but along the way, I definitely discovered and have really focused on this, that innovation is much broader than just tech invention. It's really, especially when you talk about startups and product-led invention or product-led growth and innovation, it's really focused on that product, right? Where's the market going? Where are your customers? What does the product need to be to satisfy that? And what business model do you have to deliver? What business model and service offering really lets you capitalize on that opportunity? So that's sort of one of the big changes along the way. The other one maybe related to that is I started off in classic tech in sort of networking and comms and have in that time sort of crossed over, as you know, broadly into sort of much more of this industrial split in this much more of this industrial space and sort of leaning deeper into climate as well.
Awesome. Well, great experience space that we're going to hit on one of the questions today, helping us think about where we're at in this digital industrial curve as we spend a lot of time together. But before that, current role with Congruent Ventures, would love for you just maybe set the stage for our discussion with the listeners. Can you tell us a little bit more high level data points about Congruent Ventures generally, and then what the fund mandate is as they think about reaching out?
Yeah, so Congruent Ventures is an early stage fund which invests in companies that are, you know, leaders in delivering positive climate impact. So I'll double click on a couple terms there. Early stage means seed and Series A, and it really leans heavily into first institutional round. So Congruent is not going to shy away because things are too early. So when you're kind of just founding a company, it's a great stage for us. And climate impact is pretty broad. And I think maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. It was started in 2016. And so now climate is really popular and it's, you know, one of the surging categories, certainly in fund formation. But back in 2016, climate was not so cool. And so I think that's one of the things that really differentiates Congruent is that the fund was started in sort of the doldrums of the climate investing era. And it's now a team of 10 and a portfolio of over 50 companies. The team has a lot of experience through what some people think of as clean tech 1.0 and now shifting into climate. So really has a lot of experience thinking through changes in that landscape and where opportunities are. Let's see, the first check, you know, kind of depends on company need, but scales from maybe a few hundred K if it's super early to a few million if it's sort of more of a larger seed Series A. And then we raised a continuity fund earlier this year to help us scale our companies from the kind of growth and early stage sector, early stage to up through growth and IPO.
Right on. Well, you guys have been a great partner as we've co-vested in Stable Auto. So definitely encourage the listeners to reach out to you guys. And, you know, speaking of the word climate, definitely the hot topic of the day. I think New York Climate Week just wrapped up with all kinds of buzz. So let's cut through some of the buzz with this first question then. And Congruent clearly defines itself as a climate tech VC and has been focused on this, like you said, really since the outset, standing out as a leader in what has become more crowded and honestly just a little harder to define the world of climate and sustainability investing. So given your breadth of experience across energy and venture capital and industrials and others, in a world where we're constantly bombarded with all these phrases, sustainability, clean tech, climate first, ESG, et cetera, I could go on. Let's just start off by, can you define for us what is climate tech investing and what does it mean to you and Congruent? That'd be where I'd like to start.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good question. I'm actually going to duck the overall question about what climate tech investing is and ESG investing, because I do think there are a lot of different people with different lenses. So I'm not going to speak to that, but I will speak to what it means for Congruent and maybe what it means to me. So for Congruent and for me, it's pretty simple. We invest in great companies that we believe can have a positive impact. So if you look on Congruent's website, they talk about, or we talk about bits and atoms, right? So it can be software, it can be services, it can be hardware or any mix. Sure. Companies can be about deep technical innovation. So deep tech companies can be in the climate tech area. Companies can be focused on improving efficiency or productivity in the industrial sector. So they can be industrial tech, right? These names are not necessarily they're not exclusive to each other, right? So not all deep tech companies maybe are climate tech companies, but I think all industrial tech companies are climate tech companies, because if you're improving efficiency or productivity or minimizing waste in the industrial sector, you're having a positive impact on climate.
Amen. I'm in your camp, Marianne.
You know, so like there's so those two I think are maybe 100% overlapped. And then to try and like make this a little bit more concrete, if, you know, Congruent kind of laid out subdivided the climate tech landscape into four big sectors. And I think you're going to hear a lot of overlap with industrial here. One is mobility and urbanization. So for us, a really big theme here is electrification. So then, you know, we have portfolio companies like Parallel, which are electrifying rail while bringing trucking-like flexibility. So really changing kind of supply chain and delivery capabilities. We have companies like Lightship, which are redefining RVs. And then, as you mentioned, Synop before, we have companies like Synop and Presto that are building new services around rapid EV adoption. So you hear that overlap with industrial. Energy transition is another big category for us. So these are companies that are supporting transition to low carbon electrified future. That can be companies like Fervo, which is a geothermal developer, or companies like Span, which are using intelligence and digital control to really optimize the energy ecosystem. And then companies like Leap and Camus that are pure software to really optimize the energy system. And then food and ag is another big category for us, and sustainable production and consumption. So, you know, sustainable production and consumption, that's just manufacturing, right? So again, it's so highly overlapped with more broader than manufacturing, but so certainly includes manufacturing, circular economy. So really highly overlapped with, you know, what your readers or what your listeners might think of as industrial, but really significant overlap with climate as Congruent defines it.
Well, again, in agreement with you, because when you really just boil it down to who's the customer and what is the solution they're paying for that drives an ROI, there's just so much overlap and, of course, lots of buzz, but also, much more important, tons of opportunity to drive sustainability impact by virtue of just finding great companies, Marianne. So love
100%.
It.
And climate's an accelerator, right? Like, it's not a competitor for industrial. It's an accelerator for industrial. Because at any time you're minimizing waste, you're improving efficiency, you're improving outcomes, which is any kind of innovative new company, right? That's what they're doing. They're improving outcomes for less intensive utilization of resources, whether it be people or materials or whatever, then that's a positive climate contribution.
Absolutely. I like to say in construction, if you 3D print homes and you remove construction waste, that's a huge ESG contributor. If you move in the mobility space, trains, planes, and automobiles around more efficiently, less CO2. And if you get your factory complexes, hyper-local, hyper-custom manufacturing of the future, a lot of greenhouse gas complexes that come with it. So again, lots of marketing words, but love the mission you guys are on. And that's why we love to co-invest with you guys. So we'll leave the climate definition to evolve as we go. But moving us forward, and this is a fun topic given our time at GE Ventures together, let's talk more about that layer you mentioned earlier and the focus of this podcast as we define digital industrial innovation. And, you know, you've clearly been deep in the ecosystem for many years, investing in and advising companies across a range of sectors and applications, some pure software plays, others hardware oriented, in areas from IoT to solar to 3D printing to electronic switches, even industrial marketplaces. So you really have seen it all. And with the benefit of hindsight, as well as what you're actively looking at today at Congruent that outlines, in quote, backing teams innovating across atoms, bits, and business models, bringing it home, how would you describe this moment in the digital industrial innovation curve? And where are we going next as the venture market resets, broadly speaking?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still in early days in this innovation curve. As many of your guests have noticed, it's like an amazing time from a technology innovation and just an adoption perspective. So on the tech side, we obviously have huge, you know, disruptions driven by digital, cloud, mobile, smart devices, IoT. That's now just all supercharged by AI. And as your guests have noted before, that just means digital can be applied to workflow, can be applied to physical processes, can be applied to traditional industry. And I think we're really early in that curve and getting better at it, right? Like, I think sort of the customers, the challenges in those industries, where the problems are, how to tailor and address, I think we're getting better at, and entrepreneurs are getting smarter about how to do this. We also are broadening that kind of tech disruption across more capabilities as well. If you look in bioengineering, we have CRISPR, so now we can bring engineering and design to biology. And in the sort of more climate space, we have this kind of electrification push, which is kind of tied to renewables and decarbonization, but also brings a much more distributed network as a result of that, and much greater capability for digital control and coordination. So we have these great underlying capabilities that these sort of technology adoption curves that are just increasing that give more capabilities. And so I think one of the macro things that comes out of that is that historically, if you looked at manufacturing or energy production or, you know, supply chain or whatever we tend to think about in these categories, you really kind of, it was all kind of brute force, right? Because you do everything at large scale for kind of crude consideration, like a, you had to, energy was at very large scale production for efficiency, but you had tons of distribution losses. Manufacturing, you do sort of 6 month annual forecasting planning, and you just crank things out in as low SKU complexity as possible at a centralized site. So you could maximize manufacturing scale, but maybe distribution network wasn't as efficient. But we've reached this capability that we can have much more of a scalpel-like capability because we have this digital coordination across these distributed networks. So we can optimize for individual outcomes and individual considerations, as well as optimizing the whole at the same time versus having a trade-off. And this is, you know, this showed up in consumer really early. You look at how Netflix designs content now. That's all about what users want and then customizing product to it. And it's really efficient production too. So now we're bringing that kind of capability into our physical world. And that's like a huge opportunity. So some of the things I think your guests are familiar with are, say, smart manufacturing and putting sensors and control into that. But that's now like evolving into kind of broader areas like smart mining, right? If I can have a physics-based model of how geology is modeled in terms of physical space and the characteristics associated with it and the signatures of different minerals, I can be much, much more targeted in terms of how I excavate, or I can be much, much more targeted in how I discover materials, or how I can do biological formulation. So this idea of bringing kind of digital into this physical realm is so expansive in terms of its potential reach and scope. So I think we're still at the beginning of that curve. Yeah. And we have early successes, but we have a lot more that we can do.
Yeah, early innings and a lot of good foundation just last decade alone. And this is obviously a podcast around venture orientation in some regards. So venture helped lay a lot of that foundation that I would even argue, and maybe a subsegment to the question I did want to ask. I get a lot of feedback around when you do have a hardware-enabled business model in these categories, and you know the maturity of software is eating the world, software is democratized, but with hardware now we've got a lot of lessons learned under our belt. I think was it SVB and Eclipse did like a massive hardware metrics write-up last year to really help bring to light what it takes to build a healthy business model if you do happen to have a piece of hardware involved. So maybe as a subsegment of all of that maturity that's going on, when there is a business model that has hardware as an enabler or as a part of the complete solution, you know, how do you think about that, again, given this venture market reset of sorts? I just, it's such a hot topic right now. I did want to pulse you from your experience.
Yeah, so I think hardware somehow became a sort of dirty word somewhere along the way, and people didn't like hardware because it was capital intensive, or then people didn't like hardware because it wasn't a recurring service model, or, you know, there were sort of lots of reasons people sort of became anti-hardware. Hardware is still the way the world works though, right? So I think there's just nothing wrong with hardware as a product. If you look at, obviously for industrial, Tesla's a big success, right? They make cars. That's a hardware-based business model. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think what we've certainly learned is that hardware can be enhanced by digital capabilities. So if you can bring, over-the-air updates and upgrades, if you can have autonomous assist, if you can bring all of these different additional services on top of it, that's incredible, and we should do that. And we can also bring now software into assisting materials recycling or reclamation or materials extraction or discovery, like I talked about earlier. So hardware can be supercharged by software, but you know, hardware I think is the core, is not something we should shy away from. You do have to be thoughtful about how you scale hardware manufacturing, right? And how you do that, and whether sometimes things are more efficient for customers as OPEX versus CAPEX. And you have to think, there's all this flexibility for hardware. But it should be always led and dictated by what your customers want. because that's really how you grow a business, is how you really deliver products and services that your customers love and want to adopt and solve a problem for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think we're in the golden age of hardware, I think, maybe just to sort of circle back to a shorter answer to your question.
Yeah, I mean, bits will meet atoms in most cases in some of these industrial settings. And, you know, to your point, you have to scale the right way, which is to my earlier point, like there's plenty of information out there now of how to do hardware scaling the right way. And there's lots of versions of it. But we don't get enough credit in terms of, if it's a hardware enabled business model, it can also produce a massive moat around that business that is something you can't replicate with just software. And again, neither one right answer or the other, but
it's not one versus the other, 100%. And sometimes it is just bits, right? Like sometimes there are great businesses that are just bits in industrial. So if you have a lot of data you can take advantage of to optimize a manufacturing shop floor, for example, great, right? Like that's an opportunity where just bits can be impactful. But sometimes, and I do think there's this bias towards, oh, well, we can have bits and atoms, right? Like bits and atoms is the best. But sometimes I think the product might just be atoms. It might have, you know, for example, Fervo is a great company that we have at Congruent. It is a geothermal energy developer. So at the end of the day, it's going to develop, it delivers power, right? So it's really delivering electrons, it's delivering atoms. But the technology by which they do that is obviously physical too. They build a geothermal plant. But the technology by which they run and operate that plant and they design that plant involves a lot of digitally enabled insights. So sometimes the digital is just so that you can build your atoms more efficiently and your end product can just be atoms. And I think we shouldn't be afraid of products that are just atoms.
Yeah, I think they're not mutually exclusive. It's all, you called it out, it's just what the customer wants. Listen to the customer and it'll lead you to the right solution. There's been a lot of online chatter about this hardware and software and, you know, different camps. We need it all, in my opinion. So I'll leave it to say. But moving us forward again here, this will be another fun question, kind of to the discussion around all the broad experiences and purview you've had in the sector, digital and now climate as a focus. I definitely want to go on to what is a crowd favorite for this podcast. Our audience of listeners loves learning about leading trends and areas that have fastest moving adoption within the ecosystem, especially around this climate meets industrial, super hot topic. So the section we always love to call what's hot and what's hype. Do you have any thoughts of which technologies and or innovation approaches are hot and currently being deployed at scale, since you have a purview on the scaling side, versus what areas of innovation obviously are promising, but likely to use more of a Gartner term here, overhyped right now, given immature commercial readiness? Where, throw us out some things you're thinking about.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I think maybe really well aligned with this podcast, I think some of the areas that are hot are, you know, sort of this digital insight and digital capability meets some sort of traditional industry, right? Meets a digital problem statement. So I mentioned Fervo in the section we just came from, but you know, what Fervo is what's called an enhanced geothermal developer. So they have enhanced geothermal technology. And what that actually means is they're bringing oil and gas capabilities to geothermal. So that means tighter modeling, tighter control, so that they can run the plant in a more sophisticated and more complex way. And it brings much greater capability. So you're taking this capability, this digital, digitally assisted control from another industry and bringing it to a traditional industry. And I think that's really, really a trend we're seeing scaling. We have another company, AMP, which uses AI plus robotics, right? And we're seeing that trend in lots of areas. But AMP is bringing AI and robotics to recycling plants. Mm-hmm. And so what that's doing is bringing massive efficiency improvements to materials recovery and reclamation. So this idea of taking technology that is adopted and mature from other industries and bringing them to a new problem statement, I think that's just really one that we see tons of legs behind. Give you another example in energy. Span is taking digital forecasting and control. So, you know, it's sort of riding on the fact that more consumers have solar and solar electric vehicles and energy storage, and then taking digital forecasting and control of those resources and sort of this amplifying electrical trend, amplifying trend around electrification, to apply that to home energy use and then overall energy optimization. So this idea of taking, you know, capabilities, whether it be automation, digital forecasting, control, whatever, and applying it to a traditional problem statement, I think that's one that has tons of legs. For, again, in climate, this electrification is a massive trend that we've seen already huge adoption in EV, and, you know, we're in Synop together. That EV proliferation drives a bunch of new services as the industry and ecosystem develops around that. But we're going to see more electrification into homes as well, into, say, you know, heat pumps, and more of the home will electrify. And industry is seeing more electrification too. So I think that's another area that is more nascent, but we see a lot of tailwinds behind. And the IRA, of course, is going to be a massive accelerator on that with the amount of capital that's being injected.
Yeah, I mean, so many broad different ways of opportunities, to say the least, out there. I always love to flip it, though, too, and say, you know, where's something, again, that's promising, but in your opinion, maybe it's got a market timing that's a little too far out? Because timing is, you know,
timing is everything.
Too early, right? Is wrong in venture, right?
Yeah. If you're too early, you're wrong. Absolutely. Well, so I think one of the areas that I think is overhyped and there's definitely nuance in this, but, you know, sure. I'll just say AI Mad Libs, right? So I'm sure you see this, Ty, as well, right? Every company is AI plus something, right? So like I said, take digital, apply it to a problem statement. So that's an easy thing to do with AI. I'm going to take AI and apply it to fill in the blank, right? It's literally Mad Libs at this time, at this point in the industry. But AI is obviously going to be transformational. But is it AI that's mature and ready for adoption? And is it being applied to a sector that actually cares about it, where AI can be impactful and you've identified a problem and a workflow and, you know, like a sort of product solution to a problem the industry is having? And if you don't have that real problem statement and a solution that addresses that real problem statement, it's just not going to matter. And I think today we're just seeing AI kind of sprinkled like fairy dust across all sorts of things. And at the root, if you don't have a good problem statement and a great product solution, it just doesn't matter if you sprinkle AI liberally across the top of that. So I think that's obviously something that's kind of overhyped in the moment.
Yeah, I think the Mad Libs example or analogy is a good one. It's not me, so I won't get in trouble. But I think Eric Paley had some recent words of venture looking to pump up the next buzzword or the next thing. And I'm with you. AI is going to be transformational. I used it to help plan my family's vacation over the summer. But in industrials, for sure, I know enough. It comes down to knowing what the customer needs and what their use cases are. And that's going to take precedence over using the word AI when I think about
right.
What gets me excited. So,
And you know, like some of the companies I've mentioned use AI, right? So I'm certainly not against AI. I'm just sort
of
I think, you know, I'm just sort of making a point that you have to have a problem statement that's meaningful before you sprinkle AI on top of that. And then maybe you have a problem statement where AI is not useful, and that's fine too, right? Like we shouldn't be just rushing headlong into AI.
Incredible product enhancers virtually across all of our portfolio as well. So I think your point is well taken. So we always like to bring this podcast back at some point to those folks in the arena, the founders themselves, and give them some words of wisdom that maybe are out there raising or thinking about engaging Congruent Ventures, which I encourage them to do. So maybe a word of advice split between maybe a key for success to set them up or a common challenge to avoid as they enter the chat.
And I'm just pausing because there's so much to say here, but I'm trying to keep it a little bit pithy. So I think, you know, keys to success as an early stage company, I've said this a bunch of times, you just have to have a clear problem statement, right? There's got to be a problem that you're solving that you have particular insight around in terms of a solution that makes sense, or that problem statement. And then you have to have kind of a hypothesis and milestones to create value and a reasonable plan to execute it, right? So it's sort of like, but the biggest thing for me, at least, is that you have an understanding of the industry you want to play in and a clear problem statement that you have a solution to address. So that's just got to make sense. And it sounds simple, but it's not always that easy. So just think about that clarity. I think another piece, particularly in climate, is thinking about macro versus micro. So a lot of climate entrepreneurs think in terms of a climate imperative. And, you know, we're obviously not on the greatest trajectory from a climate perspective. And so solutions that solve for climate are great, but they don't matter if nobody's going to adopt them. So you have to translate that macro imperative into a real world problem that a customer has an issue with that they want a solution for. And I think sometimes in climate entrepreneurship, that sort of macro to micro transition gets lost a little bit, because you can't have that impact unless you solve, you know, a real world problem where customers are going to adopt.
Yep. It's always going to come back to the customers on this show as well. So couldn't agree with you more. Okay, Marianne,
and
well,
then
we always
maybe the,
well, go ahead,
actually
please.
The last thing I'll just throw in here, Ty, because this is my favorite question for sort of entrepreneurs, or one of my favorite questions for entrepreneurs.
Go for
is
it.
Why now? Right. Yep. So if it's something brand new, like why hasn't it happened before and who wants it? It's kind of just pressure testing that does a customer really care right now? And then sometimes, you know, everything old is new again, right? So sometimes it's things that people have tried before and they were too early before. And we all get that. The industry wasn't quite ready. But, you know, if you're doing something in a space that people have tried before, you got to be really crisp about what has changed now and why now is the right time. Because to your point before, timing is everything in venture. So if you're too early and you just think it should happen, but there's no clear signals that anybody really cares, you might still be too early. So that timing question is really critical.
I think it's mission critical, and everyone appreciates what the solution could do. But if you don't have the market timing right, it can be a really hard process along the way. Couldn't agree more. Well, a little bit of a rapid fire, what we call quick hitters here to jump into at the end of the show. If you're ready, Marianne, we'll get going.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right. Number one thing you're looking for when you evaluate a founder who's building in this ecosystem.
Yeah, number one thing, and it's a bit of a cheat, is because it means lots of things underneath it, but the number one thing is, can they get followership? So,
gotcha.
You know, that means that means they have like a scale of opportunity, a passion and ambition that gets people to want to work with them on that, right? They have an insight in terms of an idea of a problem that's worth solving, a solution that's worth building. So if you have that, you can get followership. If you don't have that, it's hard to get people to follow. So to me, it sort of all distills down to followership. You have to have a set of personal ethics and self-awareness that people want to work with you. You have to, you know, people have to trust that you might have great vision, but you can also execute too, right? So all of the things that we look for as VCs are also like, can they build a team, right? Can they get followership? Can they get capital to follow? Can they get great people to follow? Do I want to work for them, right? Can they get followership? So I think a lot of things distill down to that.
Have to have a gravity around them, no question. What's one resource? Could be a book, podcast, blog, whatever you recommend to our audience to follow in the ecosystem.
Yeah, a great one is What It Takes. I didn't say that so clearly. What, like the kilowatt, you know, kind of play on What It Takes. What It Takes is a great climate tech podcast. And it's really focused on founder stories. So it's kind of interviews with founders, you know, why they're starting this company, how it evolved, if they're already great successes, sort of the journey, if they're earlier, how the journey's been so far. It's a great podcast.
I'll have to check it out just because the name is so clever. I think you got me.
It's great.
One person who should be on this show to help us wave the flag and keep building an ecosystem like you, Miriam.
Yeah. There's so many good people. One great one, and super insightful given his background, Carl Bass. He's a former CEO of Autodesk. He's, you know, now a board, he's now a maker. He has this machine shop up in Berkeley, this amazing machine shop up in Berkeley where he makes and retrofits things. But he's also a board member, he's an investor, and obviously with his background, he thinks a lot about digital meets physical and opportunities that arise at that intersection. Really interesting, really thoughtful guy.
Well, you have great taste. I actually slipped that one past you. I've had Carl on and been out to that facility in Berkeley a couple times.
I
should have him again with all of his lessons learned. Absolutely. He is, again, people that are willing to give back to the ecosystem with all those lessons they've learned. He's a great one. And then finally, maybe, Mary Ann, best way for folks to reach out to you following the show.
Yeah, LinkedIn. And some of you may have tried before, and I'm not always the best, but this is part of my pledge of self-improvement that I will be much better on LinkedIn.
All right. She's on the hook for LinkedIn. Love it. It's a powerful tool. Well, Mary Ann, we have so much work to do. You know, call it climate, industrial. It all comes down to the customer. I think we've said three times in this call. So lots of opportunity just getting it started. Thank you for jumping on, sharing some wisdom, and we'll find some more to work on together.
That sounds great. Well, thanks for having me here, Ty. It was a lot of fun.